So, good morning. Today we're having a half-day sitting that completes a week of study and zazen focused on a paragraph from Dogen Zenji, Shobo Genzo's Wee Monkey. And so this morning what I'd like to do is review some of what we've been talking about and include some of the dimensions that came up during this week of study. Dogen Zenji's Shobo Genzo's Wee Monkey, the translation of that is the Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, Record of Things Heard, is a collection of informal Dharma talks by Eihei Dogen, the founder of our school, Soto Zen, recorded by his disciple, Koen Eijo, from 1236 to 1239. So just a few words about Koen Eijo. He was Dogen's contemporary in age. Before becoming Dogen's disciple, he studied and practiced Tendai at Mount Hiei, Pure Land Buddhism with a disciple of Honen, Rinzai Zen in the Daruma school. So, and he is said to have had a deep awakening when he was studying Rinzai and practicing Rinzai. So by the age of 27, he was a longtime practitioner, very dedicated practitioner. And there's some idea that he was a little skeptical of Dogen when he heard that Dogen had returned from China and was teaching. But he sought him out. And I think that's important because it shows us something of Eijo's character. He sought out a contemporary in age to learn. It reflects this deep desire to keep growing in the Dharma and a sense of humility that drove him to seek out the Dharma wherever he could. When we hear later in this teaching that not to follow our ego-driven self, I think we can remember Eijo's willingness to set everything aside and become an example to us of seeking out the Dharma. So when Eijo met Dogen, he was deeply impressed and asked to become his student. And Dogen asked him to wait until he had established his monastery. So when Koshoji Monastery, Dogen's first monastery, was founded in 1233, Eijo joined him. And then in 1234 began recording Dogen's talks. Obviously not on a tape recorder, but recording his thoughts, recording what he heard. So he would hear something and he would go and write it down. So we're hearing not just Dogen, but in a sense, Eijo as well. So Eijo kept the text. When he finished writing, he kept it, assumed for his own use. And after he died, one of his disciples found it and copied it, and it began generation after generation of people hand copying this Shobo Genzo's Wee Monkey. And then later on it became copied in wood blocks and then finally printed. So this text is sometimes thought of as the easiest of Dogen's writings to understand. It's more concrete in language and references than many of Dogen's other writings. In some ways, we can think of it as a practical guide to practice. However, I think one of the things we've seen is that this concrete language and examples doesn't mean that it's any less deep than the other writings. And when we spend time with it, like we have this last week, I think we can reflect on that. So there's several different versions of it, and what we were using and what we'll be talking about today is Shohaku Okumura's translation that recently came out. And this is the section we studied, so I'll read it for you and then go through the lines and we can talk about them. Students of the Way, each one of us should reflect on our own self. To reflect on ourself means to examine how we behave with our body and mind. Patrobe monks are already the children of Shakyamuni. We must follow the lifestyle of the Tathagata, the Buddha. There are codes of dignified conduct regarding the manner of body, speech, and thought that have been carried out by 1,000 Buddhas. All of us should follow them. Even in the lay world, it is said our clothes should be in accordance with the law, our speech should correspond with the way. We, and this is, he's referring to the monks here, speaking to monks, must never follow our own ego-centered self. So, the first line, students of the way, each one of us should reflect on our own self. Students of the way are us, all of us. The Zui monkey was spoken to monks, but it has as much to say to us as it does to them. And it's vital that we not exclude ourselves from this or any of the teachings because we're not monastics. So this is particularly true of any of Dogen's writings. I'm just going to pull this down. Devotion to the way is the only requirement for being a person the way. And devotion can take many forms. So we start there. We start with the assumption that we are fully students of the way, and we are alert to the various ways that we can embody it. We can embody it in our homes, we can embody it at work, we can embody it in the Zendo, we can embody it in many, many myriad different ways. So, with that as the baseline, Dogen's saying, each one of us should reflect on our own self. This is the challenge. How do we reflect on the self? How does the self reflect on the self? To start, we can think of this as taking on responsibility for our lives and our practice. Each of us as an individual in the context of our community. We bend our attention. We reflect. We bend our attention toward what we assume the self is. We try and see as clearly as we can what there is, all of it, accurate, deep, inclusive. We look for distortions, for warped perceptions, for limited views, and we thoughtfully consider what we see. As we look deeper, we can see that we are both a unique, real entity, and we are not fixed, we are not frozen, we are without permanence. And we notice that our inquiry changes that with what it reflects. There's a kind of back and forth to it. All change, all fluid, and yet not nothing. So in a sense, the way I thought of it is we have a ringside seat to the basis of how we are in the world, our own self, not someone else's, or what we think we are, or what we think we should be, but we actually look and see deeply all of it. So we're not deconstructing a personal narrative here, though that can be useful at times. We get to know the wily ways of our minds and hearts, and that helps us to see, to not become lost, distracted, confused, or at sea. We, by doing this practice, we spot the signposts that keep us close to the path we seek to follow. So we're looking at the process of our lives. We're looking at what we do and how we are. And when we do that, we see this fluid, dynamic self. we deepen our understanding. We become more free. So he goes on to say, to reflect on ourselves means to examine how we behave with our own body and mind. This is a really important point. He's telling us to look at our behavior. That's what tells us who we are. Not looking for a fixed self. Who we are is what we are in a given moment. So we attend, and in that attending, aliveness and flexibility and a kind of fearlessness comes to the fore. So this is not just about our thoughts. Mind is both thoughts and emotions. It's anything in our consciousness. The whole array of what happens. And body is not secondary. Our body-mind is one entity. To think of how we own a body, our body, even that's kind of strange, don't you think? Like there's something else besides our body that owns our body. That doesn't make any sense at all. This unity of body-mind is essential to Dogen's teachings and underlies the practice. The mind is trained through the body just as much as the body follows the mind. So it's always a dynamic event. Then he goes on to say, patched robes, monks, are already the children of Shakyamuni. We must follow the lifestyle of the Tathagata. Patched robe monks are already the children of Shakyamuni. So several people in the intensive noticed in particular the reference to patch-robed monks and the feeling of being patch-robed, using what is available, being humble, not getting caught by appearances, the need for fancy things, and also the sense of being patched together, being a patch-robe entity. And I think this is a really good point. The patched robe Dogen refers to is the kesa, and the raka suit that we wear and when we've taken the precepts. So this is Buddha's robe. It is also a way for us to explore what we value and what we express in our lives. So this complexity, this patched robeness, is shot through our lives, and it's honorable. It's to be revered. The robe was originally made from what was called waistcloth. And there's a whole long list of what waistcloth is. It's something that's already been used, often for reasons that seem maybe even offensive, unlikely. The material that's used to wash a dead person or in childbirth or menstrual cloth. Later, the robe was made from cloth given as alms or purchased with funds that come from right livelihood. This is currently what we do. But the point is humility, staying with what is useful, taking care, and being patch-robed. I really like that, being patch-robed and honoring that patch-robedness. In the case of Kodoku, one of the two fascicles Dogen wrote on the kesa, he said, the kesa from ancient times has been called the garment of liberation. So, having respectfully encountered the teachings, we put it into practice every day. So without diminishing the uniqueness of the kesa, we can think imaginatively about what it means to wear liberation in our daily lives. Thanks, Mark. What does that mean, to wear liberation? What does it mean to honor the patched robeness of how we are what we are? How can we be thoughtful about what the garment of liberation is? In the teachings, we hear again and again that we are the children of Buddha. This is something that we say in particular in the precept ceremony. A child shares the essential nature of the parent in the sense that humans are born of humans, right? We're not clones. We are unique. But we share the DNA of our ancestors. And the many, many, many causes and conditions in our life create each of us. So Shakyamuni Buddha is the Buddha of this Buddha field, this one, this messy earth, this place. He is the awakened one, the human that started the path that we follow. An example, an embodiment of enlightenment. So I like to think of Buddha, when I think of Buddha, I think of bare feet on a dusty path. You know, walking a dusty path in this patched room. So what Dogen is telling us here is that we are essentially not different from the Buddha. Already. And the practice is the way we realize this and express our true nature. So I think it can be difficult, maybe it isn't for you, but it was for me, to get our heads around already. What does it mean? Already. We often think, well, surely not me, not this one. I should work really hard and become someone else. I should perfect this self. I should be less grumpy or certainly more enlightened or more kind, or I should study more, or I should know more. I should not get frightened. All of these things. Or if we've been at it for a while, we think, well, this is a scam. I've been at this for all these years and I'm still getting grumpy. I still get tired. I'm not happy all the time. What the hell is this about? Right? And that brings us right up against already. Right up against already. Because it's not about becoming someone else. Even as we work to become more patient, to listen more deeply, to love more thoroughly. That's true, and we grow in that. But completeness and wholeness are not about perfection. The teaching says, already, no need to be someone else. And yet, we know this is not a pass. Because the next sentence says, we must follow the lifestyle of the Tathagata. This is the Buddha, right? The Tathagata is the Buddha. So what is the lifestyle of the Tathagata? It's a way of living. It's not a frozen state or a set thing. We ask ourselves, what is the way of awakening for me? What choices do I make every day that reflect my commitment to living guided by these teachings? Not as some ideal, but myself. This reflection that we do includes everything. It has to be honest. It has to be clear. It has to be inclusive. So we see it all. And we say, how do I follow the lifestyle of the Tathagata? How do I follow the way of the Buddha? It is in the following that we realize what that is. In the action, in the movement. It is in taking responsibility and making actively choices to actively reorient. I am more than the story I tell myself or that others tell me. or what I can even imagine. This vastness and this unique particularity. The next line emphasizes this. There are codes of dignified conduct regarding the manner of body, speech, and thought that have been carried out by 1,000 Buddhas. All of us should follow them. So codes are guides of behavior. They are not forced, not harsh. They are ways of acting and living guided by the precepts and by our awareness of self and others. They bring us back to dignified conduct. We talked about dignified quite a bit, actually, in the intensive. And it was really interesting. So, Dogen writes about the dignified activity of a Buddha in Gyobutsu Igi. Know that Buddhas in the Buddha way do not wait for awakening. Again, already, right? Already. Our dignity in behavior is in following the Buddha way, in inhabiting it right now. Even when we make mistakes, even when we mess up, missing the mark with dignity is still the dignified activity of the Buddha. So how do we mess up with dignity? You know? I think that's an interesting question. No, one is humility. I'm sorry. There's dignity in I'm sorry. Let me see what I can do. There's dignity in reflecting on how we actually live. Seeing where we need to wake up more. Where we need to cultivate kindness more, or discipline more. Discipline in the sense of following what you love. No matter what, as Dogen says, the great way is wide open. Wide open, vast, and inclusive. And we do this dignified behavior with all others. And in our body, our speech, or our thought. The entirety of the physical world, the mental world, emotional world, everything. So then he says, this is carried out by 1,000 Buddhas, by innumerable Buddhas, by the lineage that we've inherited and that we carry on. That we give. In fact, if we look, we can see this dignity in all beings. I remember years ago, I worked at Kaiser Hospital, and there was a woman who worked at the front desk. And if you want to put yourself in a really, really, really difficult place and practice really, really hard, be a receptionist at a hospital that's really busy with a lot of sick people. That is like really hard. And this woman was so patient. She was so kind. I still think of her. Her name was Faye. And Faye was there for each person every day, 40 hours a week. Lines of people. People hurting. People angry. People waiting. People sick. People worried. Every person. This is dignified activity of Buddha, I'll tell you. So, Faye was not a Buddhist, much less a monk, and she teaches me still, all these years later. This is a conduct carried out by 1,000 Buddhas. So we can investigate this, we can explore this, we can look for examples, and we can find in it a deep resource for our practice, an offering of many streams of wisdom that can nourish us, inspire us. In the final lines, Dogen says, even in the lay world, it is said our clothes should be in accordance with the law, our speech should correspond with the way. We monks must never follow our ego-centered self. So even in the lay world, it is said our clothes should be in accordance with the law. So how do we imagine humbly carrying out our bodhisattva vow? What does it mean for our clothes to be in accordance with the law? This brought up an active discussion about what is the law, and this feeling of like, you know, there's this law that like tells us what we should wear, kind of like the Taliban, right? You know? I mean, honestly, there is this feeling of what is the law. But I get it. And the meaning of this is not this constrictive imperative. In this case, the law is the Dharma, the way things are, the teachings, impermanent, interconnected, fluid, never apart from everything. Our clothes are what we put on to meet the world. We reflect how we express ourselves in the world, how we interact with the world. What is this cloth of liberation that we put on every day? How can it be a bridge to others? How can it push back on constricting and toxic norms? One of the things we talked about is that one of our members, who isn't here today, likes to dress up really outrageously for gay pride with really tall silver boots and wild costumes that change every year. So there he is marching behind the Ocean Gate Zen Center banner. And when he spoke of this, he spoke not just of expressing his own nature, but of wanting to be an example to people who might see this, that they too don't have to be constricted in their self-expression, that they're worthy. It was deeply moving to hear this. That they're worthy, that they don't have to buy into some toxic notion about what it means to be a worthy human being. So what we wear, both literally and figuratively, can counter such constricted notions for ourselves and others. That's following the law. Similarly, he emphasizes that our speech should correspond with the way. What we say with our words, with our eyes, with our hands, with our posture, all of this impacts ourselves and others. To take that into account is to be guided by the teachings. Silence, too, is speech. When we give room for silence, when we deeply listen to others, that's a kind of speech. Does this speech correspond with the way? Does it correspond with the needs of this circumstance, with this person, with this being? Does it take all of it into account? This too is a way of breaking up constricted notions about who we are and what we should be. Spontaneity and outrageousness are a part of this as well, as silence, patience, awareness. What is appropriate for this situation? What speech, what expression is required now? Not in a tight, fearful way, but in a live way that meets it and expresses who we are. Finally, Dogen tells us that we monks must never follow our ego-centered self. Now, this brought up a whole other set of conversations. It was really good. What is ego-centered self? This can sound as if we should not care for ourselves or include our own wants or individuality, but that is not what he's saying. Dogen is telling us that we should be alert to the ego-centered self. Well, what does that mean? That self is the self that is deluded about the nature of who we are. It is a self that does not realize that it is not isolated, not separate. It is not permanent or fixed or trapped in delusion. That ego-centered self keeps us working constantly to be something other than what we are, to protect, to grasp, to hold on, to fight, to defend, because that's all it knows, that ego-centered self. That's all it knows. So we don't hate it. That is nothing more than another expression of aggression and grasping. So sad to do that. When we are trapped by this ego-centered self, this self that does not know itself, we don't know that our peace and our liberation is directly tied to coming to know directly and intimately a valid, vital, subjective experience that is not rooted in that foolishness. That self, so to speak, knows the truth of interdependence, becomes the truth of interdependence, and that can include the ego-centered self. So there's no war here. It's just a matter of expanding. So we're not trying to eradicate the ego-centered self as if that were possible. It's about not being limited to it, not following it. So, in a sense, our life is one course correct after another. And it's in the course correction that we find aliveness and connection. Not in eliminating one part, but in that with all beings, course correct, course correct, course correct. So it's kind of like a good tracking dog, you know, those dogs. Dogs have, we were just talking about this, dogs have an incredible sense of smell. Eileen was saying her dog can smell the medication she's trying to give them, no matter what she puts it in, right? Because they can smell things like a gazillion times more than we can. So we can think of this process of not following our ego-centered self as being like a good tracking dog. So we catch the scent. We catch the scent of a vital, interdependent, subjective experience. This self, sometimes called the authentic self or the big self or the realized self. That's tricky because it sounds like there's some other self. There's something that we're going to discover and become. But it's that which can course correct, not a fixed entity. And we catch the scent of that and then we follow that scent home. Home to this moment. That's what all of this is about.